Gethin. The reason I'm laughing is because literally about 20 seconds ago, you said it's that singing thing. Gethin, welcome to the podcast. And if you would like to sing on the podcast, you're more than welcome.
Okay, thank you. I will surprise you with a lick of something at some point.
Oh, will you?
Sure.
You know, isn't that cliche thing? Oh, well, all actors, they can really sing. And all Welsh people, they can really sing.
All Welsh people can really sing. So it's in the blood. Singing is, and dancing, as it turns out, are two of my favourite things to do. But I do them less and less in life. And it was...
Sorry, just rewind. Go. Right. Singing and dancing are your two favourite things to do in life.
They bring joy. Dancing, the physical release, it's an innately healthy thing to do, even when you're doing it with, you know, having late nights or drinking. But the dancing is what makes those things fun, I guess, when you're young and sort of sustainable, is that you're physically dancing so much. And then singing is just something I've always, especially singing as part of a group, is a really community building thing. It's indescribable to me, but I love doing it. But then I also have this deep, I guess, inner child that was somewhat embarrassed at his singing on his own, and so I have a fear of singing on my own that I should and have got over in certain sort of professional contexts. But anyway, yeah. But I do love it.
But yeah. When you were a child, you were singing, because about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But as an adult, the fear of singing on your own, it's because of you're worried about being judged always. And as an actor, a performer, you're constantly judged, and yet your biggest fear is being judged.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about singing specifically, and actually managing acting in that thing as well, is like really, I guess the idea is that you share yourself through the role. I used to think very clearly that it was hiding, that the idea was to hide yourself and present something else, but really there has to be a fusion of you bringing something through the text and the character and the story that you're involved with. You have to bring yourself to it, which is terrifying actually when you start trying to do it and failing at that as well.
Why would you fail at that?
Well, I mean, because you just get in the way of yourself. I mean, I think that's there are many things that can get in the way of you sharing yourself in an authentic way, and I think I've probably practiced those over the years for different reasons. And the craft is to try and develop a quick way to avoid doing that. And usually it's just following the craft, rehearsing, preparing, and in the work you find it actually a release to just be there and present and inhabit and be rather than perform. But the thing about singing, and I think I remember learning this, that it's a different part of your brain that operates your singing register than your speaking voice, right? And so there's a different emotional connection to really, you really are, you can't sing and not open yourself. You kind of have to open yourself to sing. And when you're doing that with people in concert or in harmony or, you know, together, then... of course, that's a hugely bonding experience. It can be, you know, and I'm really heartened, you know, for life, you know, moving me around the place and work and all that things. And I haven't been part of a choir or a choral group or just a group of people singing for a long time. But I took it just before COVID, actually, which was sort of well-timed in a way. But I went and sang with a couple of choirs in London, just did their taster sessions, and one of which was the London Welsh Male Voice Choir, which was a really a very emotional experience for me, because it was a very accepting... They're incredibly talented singers, but they're, you know, you can go along and sing along with them. And
so anyone can go and sing with them.
If
you're male and Welsh.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, this is the thing. I think they're open to, you know, because I have that thing of being, you know, English and Welsh. I was born and raised in England. I have Welsh parents, and I'm very sort of proud of that heritage and feel it very deeply, especially in rugby. But you know, I think I contacted them and said, you know, can I come and just join a session? And they were just, of course, you know,
Oh, how
lovely. I think if you if you're serious about singing, they're an incredible choir and you have to really, you know.
So this was pre-COVID, so would you go back now and do it?
Well, funny enough, yeah. I mean, the only reason I didn't sort of go for more sessions or, you know, I mean, they are a serious, serious choir and they go on tours and obviously make recordings. I suddenly was needed to be in another country to do some work for nearly a year. So that sort of put an end to that.
Was that Game of Thrones then?
No, that was a show called Manhunt. Manhunt Deadly Games. So I had to go to Pittsburgh. It's funny the things that come up in conversations like this, because I was thinking about it the other day. I was like, oh, I should just go along.
And
see if I can tag along at another session.
It's very funny because singing is something, I mean, I passionately love it and I'm lucky that I've done it on stage. But if somebody said to me now, right, can you go and do a musical again tomorrow? I'd be... But then when I got out there, it would be yes, because it like you say, it opens your soul and you just...
Yeah, yeah.
And but it is that people have so much fear about being judged when they sing.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't dance, but I jump around the streets with complete strangers and I don't mind. But it is about people being judged.
Mm.
And it's interesting, when I said that, I suppose all actors put themselves out there all the time. And do you read your reviews?
I have done in the past. And I think, I wouldn't make a habit of it now. I sort of keep abreast of, like, how things are going for a project, you know, especially if it's one close to my heart. You know, it's nice to know it's a good thing to keep tabs on a little bit. But as far as it... specifically reading reviews, especially when you're doing a play, it's just a no-go because you're still doing it. You know, a film's one thing. You made it a year and a half ago. You might even have opinions about the project yourself. But when you're, you know, the whole sort of opening week review thing, no. I mean, I did when I was, very young and wouldn't do it again.
No. And every actor says, no, I don't read the reviews. And every actor, of course, they do.
Yeah, on some level, as I say, and also sometimes you can't sort of avoid them because people send them to you. Not bad ones. Well, I mean, I think I've definitely...
Oh, that's nice.
They come to you other ways where you're, you know... Yeah, I don't think I've ever been sent like a really horrible one, but I've definitely been sent a kind of like, well, there's no need to share that one about the whole thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, it just sort of like, I'm not, you know, I'm trying to keep my blinkers on a little bit.
Why do people do that?
I don't know. Probably because out of a really good place of just trying to share an enthusiasm for what you're up to, probably.
You hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the way you're being positive about these people in your life. Okay. It's funny because we started where I thought we were going to end on the singing thing. But I mean, it's so lovely because you came onto my radio show and you were coming in for 7 minutes or something and you stayed for ages because I just wanted to talk more and more to you because you love what you do. And I think you're properly the sort of person that I love spending time with, because you do have this innate joy for life.
Oh, well, that,
you do.
That's a really lovely thing to hear, and I really mean that from the bottom of my feet up. Because I do. I think I do. I do have this kind of whatever life throws at all of us at any time. There's the underpinning it all. You've just got to. Put a smile on it and get through things and be game. And I've definitely gone on a journey with that. I mean, the one thing that's certain is that we all change. And I think I've changed in many different ways over the years. And some of them was to very much hide myself from my own kind of joy, really, or connection to just, you know, having a positive attitude. And I think that's okay too. You know,
but there are too many people who, and I talk about it all the time, so apologies. But and in my book, I just say I used to apologise for being happy all the time. Now I know I don't have to apologise. You don't have to. And you're saying the same thing that you felt. I'm positive. Oh, I shouldn't be. Oh, because what will people think?
Yeah. It's that, and it's also very infectious meeting you. I mean, I think...
No, this is about you.
I'll pick up on that. But if you'll allow me, like, there is an element of, well, as of it being that kind of energy being infectious. And it's a wonderful thing to be around people who bring it out in you as well. So I thank you for that. But also, then there's a realisation, well, if I'm just who I am, then I'll just maybe bring it out in others or, you know, Yeah, you know, it's just...
Did your diagnosis of having being diabetic, did that change you? Do you think that was part of the change in you?
Definitely, it's something I look back on. So I was diagnosed in 1999 when I was about 14 or 15. And so I was right in the middle of big school and sort of starting to tear at life. And then this thing was sort of introduced into my life. And I look back on it and I can't remember, and I may be wrong, you know, I may be misremembered. I can't really remember any other sort of feeling or action than, okay, right, we'll just get on with it. And
that's amazing.
But I'm sure I was difficult to other people because I was probably learning how to be a diabetic. And also the other thing I should share about me being a joyful person is I'm also at times, you know, slightly irritable, and that does, there are parts of that that have to do with living with a condition that kind of is so up and down with your metabolism and your hormonal balance and things like that, that you know, if you're having a sugar low, you can get a bit cranky and or sort of irrationally abrupt, and it's because your body's telling you to do something about.
Talk to me about diabetes, because I mean, I think we all think we know about it. We all know somebody who has diabetes, or we've met somebody that has it, or we've read about it, that sort of thing. But just talk to me about day-to-day living with it.
That's a really good question. That's the one that really it points to, because it's a chronic condition. It is every day. And within the sort of diabetes healthcare community, there's things, there are phrases that they use, like full-time job, having diabetes, and...
The diabetes is a full-time job.
It is a full-time job. And that, it's a burden and things like that, which are all sort of very negative-sounding things. But really, to have someone else tell you that is sort of a recognition that, yeah, it can be a lot to manage, but essentially you just have to get on with it. And I remember as a child thinking, you know, there are other things that I could have been diagnosed with that would have been much more life disrupting. And actually, this is an opportunity to pay attention to health, which I have variously succeeded and failed at as well over the years. But so living with it day to day is a case of you, as a type 1 diabetic, you eat food and you inject insulin, whether it's via a pen device or pump device, to match that food so that it is used in the correct way in your body to fuel your body. That's a sort of simple description of it. So what you're trying to do is keep within a mid-level balanced place, and your blood sugar levels will sort of look like this, and a diabetic who's doing
so go up and down on a gentle ripple.
Gentle ripple, yeah. Right. Of course, we're on a podcast, of course. Yeah, sort of a shallow waveline. Whereas a diabetic who is very well controlled, they will be slightly higher peaks and troughs.
Okay.
And then on challenging days, when you get a cold, or if you get a virus that you're unaware of, or if you're just having a bad time of it, the wave can have really high peaks and troughs, and that affects all your other hormones,
right,
which can affect things like mood.
What are the highs and what are the lows then?
So a high sugar will... So let's, for example, if you have a high blood glucose level, higher than it should be, then that means either that you didn't inject enough to eat the food that you ate, or at the wrong time. And what your body then does is it has a higher concentration of glucose in the blood, and that affects lots of things. And it can really affect you. If you had that over a long period of time, that would really impact your health. Things like, they call them complications. You know, it will affect your eyesight later in life. It'll affect your capillary health, which can, you know, lead to really, really bad outcomes. So, that's a high, and then a low is slightly more immediately dangerous. It can be. It doesn't have to be. But essentially, if you inject too much insulin for the food that you consume, or you exercise a bit more than you thought you were going to that day, and you have a sugar low, that is when the glucose level in your blood is maybe not sufficient for your major organs to do what they should be doing, your brain, all of you. And so that can that's immediately dangerous, which is why... If you ever see a diabetic saying, give me sugar, and it's confusing because you think, shouldn't diabetics be avoiding sugar? That's a type 1 diabetic saying they're having a sugar low, they need sugar right now to get their body back to just that level base that we all should be at, And then, you know, they can progress. From
and so do you carry stuff around? You carry
Absolutely.
Sugar with you?
I got my jelly babies in my bag right there.
And they're as simple as that?
Yeah, for me, and it is different for people. It's different for every diabetic, and diabetics will tell you that. But for me, three or four jelly babies and a half of a protein, like a granola-y protein bar, will kind of set me back. And then I can look at, you know, what's the next meal and what am I doing in the next couple of hours. So it is. I have a thing because my lows now have an emotional element to them. I sort of feel like I can get a bit down.
That's understandable.
Well, this is because they used to bring things like a genius complex. Like, when I was younger, I used to feel like a superhuman on the way down. And I don't know, and this is not a medical thing that I've asked anyone, but I was wondering if the fight or flight hormones in your body, because you're sort of crashing, are giving you a sort of false energy to go and get the thing you
that
need.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it's a theory. I should probably run that by diabetes specialist.
But actually, diabetics who are listening to this who have that, I think, oh, that's me. Yeah. Or there'll be something, go, no, that's not how I feel. But it's interesting. I met a young lad before Christmas, and I think he was 6 or 7. And he said it's a superpower. And the same way that a friend of ours who's got a young son who's autistic, severely autistic, and he finds everything very difficult. But he's learnt that I have a superpower. It's what he tells everybody. And actually, I think it's now that people own it and talk about it. Because years ago, people didn't talk about being diabetic.
No.
They were sort of ashamed. It was like, shh, don't tell anybody. But
Especially, I think it is. I mean, I sort of, because I got it, I guess, in the late 90s, all throughout my sort of life with it, it's just becoming more and more, like all health things, really, that we should just be open about and talk about, like mental health and things like that, have just progressively got more and more talked about. So it's just felt to me like an upward swing of just transparency about what we're all going through and sharing, right?
Good.
So I don't remember, but I can imagine, and I do remember being a bit scared of it before I had it, because I think I met someone when I was like a small child, a teenager who had it and was dealing with it very well. But someone had said something that it was a really bad thing to have or something like that. And it is, you know, it's a lifelong condition to manage. And there are sort of challenges with that, but it's completely manageable.
And you can do anything with it. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, the sports stars that I've interviewed and the actors and the musicians and they who just thought, oh, will I be able to? And, you know, you were in the biggest show on the planet. And we're not exaggerating, because Game of Thrones was one of those shows that took the world by, which we'll talk about in a minute. That must be so weird that the whole world knows you. But look, you were in a massive show.
Yeah, and I had exactly that thought. The moment I got it, I remember the week that I got it. I was rehearsing. I was rehearsing Macbeth. At school.
As you do.
And I one of the things that happens when you're diagnosed is you can lose weight quite quickly, especially if you're a young person, you know, a child. So I lost weight very quickly. And my mum, you know, was just like over 3 days, was like, no, doctor, now. And it got to the third day.
Thank goodness for your mum.
Yeah, of course. So your mum's look at you that funny way. And I was a teenager. I was like, mum, I'm fine, you know. And I was like, I'm going to rehearsal. And there was just this one woman where she just refused to let me go to school that day. And I just wanted to go to my Macbeth rehearsal. But then I got it and then did that play that summer at the Edinburgh Fringe. But did have that thought of like, oh, but maybe I can't do this as a job. And it's just nonsense, you know. There's pretty much everything you can do. I'm sure there's maybe the odd exception of a career.
But acting you can do. You can be on a major set.
Oh, exactly.
So do you tell people then, you know, in the middle of Game of Thrones, while there's all the extraordinary things going on. Do you say, sorry, hold on a minute.
I try. I mean, yeah, basically what I do, I have over the years gotten used to the best people on set are the third ADs or production assistants.
So for people who don't know what an AD is.
Exactly, sometimes called runners. So the people who make the set work. The production assistants who are between the cast and the crew, sort of just running around. That's why they were called
looking
runners.
Looking after everybody.
And they tend to be incredibly smart people who want to get into the industry and all that kind of thing. Incredibly energised. Basically, I make friends with someone like that early on in a show and just check in and just, you know, you tell the bosses this is the thing, but you try and it doesn't affect The only thing to you tell the company so that if anything, like a major incident were to occur, they know, because that affects like medical, you know.
Yeah,
care.
Of course.
But that, you know, I've never had a diabetes related thing ever in my life, you know. But with the production assistants or the ADs or the runners, it's basically you just become chummy enough to kind of go, when I ask for a Lucozade, it's not because I'm just, you know, it's like, and
not being a diva.
Yeah, exactly. And it's partly my thing about being, you know, one of those people that doesn't want to come across as a diva. I'm sure I've been a diva. But it's like, yeah, that's the only reason I would ask you to get me a drink is in a short space of time, which is sometimes necessary for actors. Because if you're, it's not being a diva if you're sort of literally sort of screwed into a piece of wood, unable to move for several hours, as I was on Game of Thrones. I just thought I'd use that as an example.
I just want a great example. But look, we've mentioned it so many times. We have to go to Game of Thrones. So when you were on my radio show, the lovely team there, one of them cried. You saw. She could not believe that she was going to be meeting you face to face. Is it extraordinary to be in a show that the world watches?
Yeah, and absolutely, like, unmistakably. It's still kind of hard to get my head around in some ways,
yeah.
Especially partly because I had an amazing time on it. But for me, it was, you know, I was at the start of the show in the first two seasons of it. My character was in season one and season two. And at that time, it felt so exciting for so many reasons. But a lot of those reasons weren't to do with it being what it became, this phenomenon. It had the potential to be very successful. But I don't think any of us had any understanding it could become what it did ultimately become. And then, of course, I saw that happen at a time when, I still, throughout the series, but especially the sort of middle era of it, if you like, I had lots of close friends still on it, and I was hearing, and, you know, no spoilers for me, but, you know, keeping in touch with people. There's still people from the show that are dear friends now. But so there was that excitement of just seeing your friends like on this thing as it is the phenomenon that it is. And then now there's this feeling of it being, I had a really close friend and someone I've worked with text me a week ago and say, I've just watched Game of Thrones, and, you know, well done, and it's brilliant, and all that kind of thing. And you think it just continues to have a life. And it is hard to get your head around. And I think mainly the wonderful feeling for someone like me is that you were part of these stories that meant so much to people. And of course, that has ups and downs as well, because people have opinions on things like how it ended and things like that. But
everybody's got an opinion on
exactly.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. But actually, basically, it's a nice thing to have to talk about, especially as you travel through the world. Like, if you know, whether it's for work or even just, you know, traveling around
in real life.
Yeah, I do travel to places other than sets and rehearsal rooms, but it's something to talk about, and I have a relationship with it that is also distant enough that it's not everything, you know. Partially about my career, but it was long enough ago, and I can have a real wry smile about it all, and just see the enjoyment people have for extreme violence in a medieval context and political, you know.
Is that so interesting? You said that none of you had really thought that it was going to be. What is it that makes something such a global smash, do you think? I mean, I suppose if we all knew, then we would do it.
Do you know what, Gary? I have tried. About 8 years ago, I tried to go, what was it? What was the chemistry of that? What was the thing? Honestly, I think as far that if you really think it through, then these books and stories that George wrote over decades built up a huge following because the stories were tested on an audience over a long period of time, and millions of people were like, we really like those. And then sort of in the showrunners and HBO stepped up a production company to say, we are going to honor those stories as best we can on television and do it authentically and do it in our own way. They had to do that. There's no way you could televise every beat of George's stories. But we're going to do that as best we can. And that's what happened. And then everyone who got involved. And there's an element of fantasy and sort of distancing story from reality that is useful, especially for a show to go all around the globe. I mean, it's clearly, George's writing is clearly rooted in sort of Northern European monarchical histories and political intrigue. It's clearly rooted in that. But he's created a world that you can kind of separate yourself from and project your own. You know, I've had people talk about over the years, fans talk about projecting their own political sort of system onto it, even though it's a kind of medieval, you know, European history. They sort of the power play and it's a family drama. It's a family drama.
Yeah.
And who doesn't relate to a family drama? And then there's also just the I don't know, the sugar and spice of it that none of us can, the secret ingredients that none of us could ever, if we could bottle that, we'd all be very successful.
Yeah. It's very interesting because somebody the other day, I interviewed somebody who's on stage in Stranger Things.
Oh, right.
And I said to them, when you were watching it on television, did you ever think you'd be doing, you know, all the cliche questions I was asking. And I sat back and thought, goodness me, that was a phenomenon. And Game of Thrones. And there are a few, I think Downton was.
Oh, yeah.
It's completely different. But Downton
sort
of took the world by storm when it first came out. And it is that we want to disappear into another world. Because those three, they're not regular date. It's, you know, I love EastEnders and I've never missed an episode, but I don't disappear into their world.
No,
well, maybe
and
I do.
But also that serves a different function and it serves a different, you know, some that I've often reflected on shows like EastEnders and things that really are a part of our lives and certainly part of my family's life or have been over the years. And, you know, people can watch for seasons and then kind of come back to it later in their life. And there's it's as a part of being a part of community.
It's
really vital, and it's the glue. There's certain kind of entertainment and stories that glue the nation together in a different way. But as you say, the escape thing, it's a bit like theme park rides. Like you want to feel you're going as close to being flung off a cliff, but you don't actually want to be flung off a cliff, which is why stories that take you out of yourself are kind of, I think, helpful. And I think, you know, and then there's, I mean, I like a lot of TV. I have nothing more to say on that.
Disappearing into another land. Yeah. How do you cope with the fame thing?
Well, I mean, I have a very particular kind of fame is a...
It's a funny word.
Because, you know, I have the privilege of being part of a story that means a lot to a lot of people. And most reasons why anyone would ever approach me who I don't know personally is to do with something they care about deeply, a story that they've enjoyed. It's not about any other reason to, you know, it's the work I've done and stuff like that. And it's not, you know, when it happens to me, you know, it's not an everyday thing, but it, you know, it comes up. It's wonderful, you know, it's manageable, it's lovely. And so I know people who have a slightly more famous and have more exposed in that way, and they manage it brilliantly and it brings different challenges. But for me, it's just certainly at the moment, it's a really lovely thing and mostly comes up in kind of really weird ways sometimes. But
do you get that look on the tube? It's the king. It's the king.
I got it in a slightly odd way once, which was I was walking down Oxford Street in a very busy street, and an American chap who I'm sure you wouldn't mind me saying looked like he was he's a really a sort of old school Midwestern farmer type, like really stocky, huge guy, but in his they'd say like later life, 60s, 70s, but you know, big man, big American man, sort of, I don't know, anyway, he just stopped me, and I just to sort of set this up, I played a version of Charles Manson in a TV show a few years after Game of Thrones, which showed in the States and here, but it's not as, you know, talked about as Game of Thrones, maybe, whatever. But I was walking down the street just doing my Christmas shopping with a shaved face, and obviously I had a really big beard like a really big and really long hair. I was clean shaved, all bright, probably going off to as I say, just walking up Oxford
Disney
Street.
Store.
I don't know what I was doing.
Disney
but I just
store.
Remember this guy he just stopped dead and went, "Charlie." And it stopped me dead because he was like, I was like, I'm in Oxford Street in London, and this guy has spotted me that looks nothing like the guy I just played, and he was saying, "You're Charlie Manson." And I was like, this is an odd relationship with his character, and, you know, that character. But, like, I was just like, how have you done that? How have you spotted that out of nowhere? I was like, because you're in London. I was like, yeah, and he was like, I didn't know you were British. And I'm like, yeah, why would you possibly make that connection? But he obviously saw, I don't know. He just, yeah, that was an odd one for me, because I was like, how on earth are you? I've got a much nicer version of this, which is on my first date, I don't talk about family much, but I think I can get away with this one. On my first date with my wonderful wife.
Oh, with your wife? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I was about to say, I won't ask any names.
Okay. Of course, yeah. We were at this lovely music venue, and I was just sort of walking her through and chatting about it. And she'd asked questions like you're asking, like, oh, because, you know, it was after Game of Thrones that we met and all that kind of thing. And she was like, "Oh, just you know." And I was like, "No, it never really happens. It really doesn't." And just as I was sort of explaining that, this a young actor out of nowhere, we were in LA, and a young actor goes, "Gavin," and ran down. And this young chap was like, just said some very nice things. And he was just like, "I've been watching a film you're in called Copenhagen, and I, you know, I've been studying you for acting class and all these like amazing things." Like that has happened once. That's what I said. But it was on my first date, so I sort of was like, "Whoever that young man is, I am incredibly grateful."
Did she say, "Okay, I'll marry you"?
Yes,
that was it.
Well, yes, yeah, straight up.
I love that. That's so sweet. But you seem, I can imagine anyone, even that big burly Midwestern American, you just being polite and nice to them.
Oh yeah, I mean, as I say, look, I have the privilege of it being a very manageable, fun thing at the moment, because it's, you know, it happens with the kind of frequency that it's just like a nice thing that, you know, and most of the energy, I mean, all of the energy I've ever got has been positive, so that's a really lovely thing too. So,
well, I mean, yeah. I've witnessed it when Lola went to pieces. That was so sweet. I can't let him into the studio. Okay, you really can. No, oh my God. It was so lovely. Okay, so the next thing you're doing, Warhol, that we've spoken about on the radio, but that's not about Andy Warhol.
No. It's about a suspense thriller of a kind. It's set in a radio station, and it's about a radio shock jock, really, an American character who's in a London radio station, kind of trying to rebuild his career, and he kind of goes off the rails. And he's played brilliantly by Corey Johnson, who's an actor that, if you know his work, you know. Mm. He's one of those actors who's just done some incredible work over the years. And this is a role that he's just incredible in. And I play this, his beleaguered sort of station manager, trying to keep him on the rails. And it's not a spoiler to say it has sort of, but yeah, it's a suspense thriller and it has a dark ending. So that's probably, but it also has this brilliant, there's three stories that weave together that sort of feature some young people trying to win a car in the radio station lot, you know, that kind of touch the,
oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
That's going on. And there's two characters who are living on the streets, and they have this sort of very suspenseful interaction over a sort of an older guy who lives on the streets and a younger guy, sort of how to be in life. And it's a beautiful kind, that in itself is just a beautiful scene. It's spread across the whole film. And they sort of, the three things come together to kind of as a sort of treaty.
Oh, it sounds really good. Right. So this is a movie. What's
a movie,
it?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It's very funny when you just mentioned about beleaguered radio manager, the team behind the glass, just sort of they gave that look of, oh, we've had to cope with those sorts before. Oh, my word. So it's interesting you're talking about homeless people, because the other thing that I know you want to talk about is Groundswell. Mm. And for people who don't know about Groundswell, you taught me about Groundswell, and I think it's really important to talk about, and I love that you're going to be working with them now some more. So explain what Groundswell is about.
Groundswell is this amazing organisation that they do everything possible to assist people who are experiencing homelessness get out of that situation. One of the things at the centre of their work is finding and treating people who are experiencing homelessness or living on the streets or sleeping rough. Any people in that situation, finding them and getting them to the healthcare they need. Because obviously it doesn't, once you think of this thought, it's really hard to unthink. But of course, people who experience homelessness are having all of the same healthcare challenges as the rest of us and more. And so their ability to access them is majorly challenged by the situation that they find themselves in for, we all know, a variety of reasons that that can affect anyone at any time. So Grounds will do this amazing thing. They have a find and treat team. They have caseworkers who all have had experience of homelessness themselves. So the other thing about Groundswell is it's an organisation that employs people who have had that experience, empowers them to then go and change the lives of others. Meeting them has been a humbling privilege, but it's amazing work that they do. And yes, I'll be learning more and more in the coming years and just spreading the word about them, basically.
Well, I'm so pleased that you have. And obviously, bring it back to where we started with diabetes. There are plenty of people on the streets. It's not a life choice, as some people say.
It's not a
life
choice.
Being homeless. but you know, there'll be people with their own health issues.
Exactly. Precisely. Yeah. And, you know, we talked about it briefly on your show, but it's that thing of, you know, diabetes is just one of the examples because, you know, it enabled me to connect the dots. Like, I know how much the NHS is amazing. We are so lucky to have
lucky.
It. And specifically the people who work within it. And I use their resources so regularly. I need to, you know, to manage this condition, which is fine. And it's an amazing thing. But it takes a bit of work. It takes a bit of organising, making sure you make appointments and things like that. And managing the equipment and the medication. Having an ongoing condition like diabetes, if you're on the streets, is just exponentially harder. And there was an example, one of the caseworkers, forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but told me about someone who was experiencing homelessness at the time and keeping their insulin refrigerated by keeping it in a bag in a canal, because that was the only option they had to keep it cold, because you have to do that. And that is one example. And of course, the other examples are the caseworkers sitting with people through their chemotherapy sessions. And I guess the reason to be joyful there is someone's doing that, and they are, and having met Dennis and Adrian and Sharon and Tracy and all of the team, as I said, it was incredibly humbling. But there are people out there doing this work, and we can help them by spreading the word, or obviously making a donation if you're able to. That's you know, like all charitable organisations, that's always going to be helpful.
I didn't know about Groundswell until you told me about them, and I'm really pleased that we can talk about it on here as well, that we can get the word out there. Gethin, you are a joy. You really are. You've just got so much good that you want to put out there, and it oozes out of you. Can you say something oozes out of something? Joe and Ed are giving me a look through the glass. They're laughing. Can you say something oozes? You can say somebody oozes. Yes, yes, yeah. I can say you ooze. There
I'm very
go.
Comfortable with oozing. And may I say, it's you know, something I learned in my job is that you really, all you're looking to do is be a mirror. And so I honestly mean it. It's been a wonderful pleasure to meet you, because
this is about you, Gethin.
It oozes out of you too.
The king. Thank you very much.